losers, he invariably answers that he was trained by the most chicken of them all, the Chicago trader Steve-O, who taught him the business. This is not true. The real reason is his training in probability and his innate skepticism. There is another reason why Nero is not as rich as others in his situation. His skepticism does not allow him to invest any of his own funds outside of treasury bonds. He therefore missed out on the great bull market. The reason he offers is that it could have turned out to be a bear market and a trap. Nero harbors a deep suspicion that the stock market is some form of an investment scam and cannot bring himself to own a stock. The difference with people around him who were enriched by the stock market was that he was cash flow rich, but his assets did not inflate at all along with the rest of the world. His treasury bonds hardly changed in value. He contrasts himself with one of those startup technology companies that were massively cash flow negative, but for which the hordes developed some infatuation. This allowed the owners to become rich from their stock valuation, and thus dependent on the randomness of the market's election of the winner. The difference with his friends of the investing variety is that he did not depend on the bull market, and accordingly does not have to worry about a bear market at all. His net worth is not a function of the investment of his savings. He does not want to depend on his investments, but on his cash earnings for his enrichment. He takes not an inch of risk with his savings, which he invests in the safest possible vehicles. Treasury bonds are safe. They are issued by the United States government, and governments can hardly go bankrupt, since they can freely print their own currency to pay back their obligation. No work ethics. Today, at 39, after 14 years in the business, he can consider himself comfortably settled. His personal portfolio contains several $1 million in medium maturity treasury bonds, enough to eliminate any worry about the future. What he likes most about proprietary trading is that it requires considerably less time than other high-paying professions. In other words, it is perfectly compatible with his non-middle-class work ethic. Trading forces someone to think hard. Those who merely work hard generally lose their focus and intellectual energy. In addition, they end up drowning in randomness. Work ethics, Nero believes, draw people to focus on noise rather than the signal. This free time has allowed him to carry on a variety of personal interests. As Nero reads voraciously and spends considerable time in the gym and museums, he cannot have a lawyer's or a doctor's schedule. Nero found the time to go back to the statistics department where he started his doctoral studies and finished the harder science doctorate in statistics by rewriting his thesis in more concise terms. Nero now teaches, once a year, a half-semester seminar called History of Probabilistic Thinking in the Mathematics Department of New York University, a class of great originality that draws excellent graduate students. He has saved enough to be able to maintain his lifestyle in the future and has contingency plans perhaps to retire into writing popular essays of the scientific literary variety, with themes revolving around probability and indeterminism, but only if some event in the future causes the markets to shut down. Nero believes that risk-conscious hard work and discipline can lead someone to achieve a comfortable life with a very high probability. Beyond that, it is all randomness, either by taking enormous and unconscious risks or by being extraordinarily lucky. Mild success can be explainable by skills and labor. Wild success is attributable to variance. There are always secrets. Nero's probabilistic introspection may have been helped out by a dramatic event in his life, one that he kept to himself. A penetrating observer might detect in Nero a measure of suspicious exuberance, an unnatural drive. For his life is not as crystalline as it may seem. Nero harbors a secret, one that will be discussed in time. John, the High Yield Trader. Through most of the 1990s, Across the street from Nero's house stood John's, a much larger one. John was a high-yield trader, but he was not a trader in the style of Nero. A brief professional conversation with him would have revealed that he presented the intellectual depth and sharpness of mind of an aerobics instructor, though not the physique. A purblind man could not have seen that John had been doing markedly better than Nero, or at least felt compelled to show it. He parked two top-of-the-line German cars in his driveway, his and hers, in addition to two convertibles, one of which was a collectible Ferrari, while Nero had been driving the same VW Cabriolet for almost a decade, and still does. The wives of John and Nero were acquaintances of the health club type, but Nero's wife felt extremely uncomfortable in the company of John's. She felt that the lady was not merely trying to impress her, but was treating her like someone inferior. While Nero had become inured to the sight of traders getting rich, and trying too hard to become sophisticated by turning into wine collectors and opera lovers, his wife had rarely encountered repressed new wealth. The type of people who felt the sting of indigence at some point in their lives and want to get even by exhibiting their wares. The only dark side of being a trader, Nero often says, is the sight of money being showered on unprepared people who are suddenly taught that Vivaldi's Four Seasons is refined music. But it was hard for his spouse to be exposed almost daily to the neighbor who kept boasting of the new decorator they just hired. John and his wife were not the least uncomfortable with the fact that their library came with the leather-bound books. Her health club reading was limited to People magazine, but her shelves included a selection of untouched books by dead American authors. She also kept discussing unpronounceable, exotic locations where they would repair during their vacations without so much as knowing the smallest thing about the places. She would have been hard to explain on which continent the Seychelles Islands are located. Nero's wife is all too human, although she kept telling herself that she did not want to be in the shoes of John's wife. She felt as if she had been somewhat swamped in the competition of life. Somehow words and reason became ineffectual in front of an oversized diamond, a monstrous house, and a sports car collection. An overpaid hick. Nero also suffered the same ambitious feeling toward his neighbors. He was quite contemptuous of John, who represented about everything he was not and does not want to be, but there was the social pressure that was starting to weigh on him. In addition, he too would have liked to have sampled such excessive wealth. Intellectual contempt does not control personal envy. That house across the street kept getting bigger, with addition after addition, and Nero's discomfort kept apace. While Nero had succeeded beyond his wildest dreams, both personally and intellectually, he was starting to consider himself as having missed a chance somewhere. In the pecking order of Wall Street, the arrival of such types as John had caused him to be a significant traitor no longer. But while he used to not care about this, John, and his house and his cars, had started to gnaw away at him. All would have been well if Nero had not had that stupid large house across the street judging him with a superficial standard every morning. Was it the animal pecking order at play, with John's house size making Nero a beta male? Even worse, John was about 5 years his junior, and despite a shorter career, was making at least 10 times his income. When they used to run into each other, Nero had a clear feeling that John tried to put him down, with barely detectable but no less potent signs of condescension. Some days, John ignored him completely. Had John been a remote character, one Nero could only read about in the papers, the situation would have been different. But there John was, in flesh and bones, and he was his neighbor. The mistake Nero made was to start talking to him, as the rule of pecking order immediately emerged. Nero tried to soothe his discomfort by recalling the behavior of Swan, the character in Proust's In Search of Time Lost, a refined art dealer and man of leisure who was at ease with such men as his personal friend, the then Prince of Wales, but acted like he had to prove something in the presence of the middle class. It was much easier for Swan to mix with the aristocratic and well-established set of Guermont than it was with the social-climbing one of the Vedorines, no doubt because he was far more confident in their presence. Likewise, Nero can exact some form of respect from prestigious and prominent people. He regularly takes long meditative walks in Paris and Venice with an erudite Nobel Prize-caliber scientist, the kind of person who no longer has to prove anything, who actively seeks his conversation. A very famous billionaire speculator calls him regularly to ask him his opinion on the valuation of some derivative securities. But there he was, obsessively trying to gain the respect of some overpaid hick with a cheap, New Jersey accent. Had I been in Nero's shoes, I would have paraded some of my scorn to John with the use of body language. But again, Nero is a nice person. Clearly, John was not as well educated, well bred, physically fit, or perceived as being as intelligent as Nero. But that was not all. He was not even as street smart as him. Nero has met true street smart people in the pits of Chicago, who exhibit a rapidity of thinking that he could not detect in John. Nero was convinced that the man was a confident, shallow thinker, who had done well because he never made an allowance for his vulnerability. But Nero could not, at times, repress his envy. He wondered whether it was an objective evaluation of John, or if it was his feelings of being slighted that led him to such an assessment of John. Perhaps it was Nero who was not quite the best trader. Maybe, if he had pushed himself harder or had sought the right opportunity, instead of thinking, writing articles, and reading complicated papers. Perhaps he should have been involved in the high-yield business, where he would have shined among those shallow thinkers like John. So Nero tried to soothe his jealousy by investigating the rules of pecking order. Psychologists have shown that most people prefer to make $70,000 when others around them are making $60,000 than to make $80,000 when others around them are making $90,000. Economics, schmeconomics, it is all pecking order, he thought. No such analysis could prevent him from assessing his condition in an absolute rather than a relative way. With John, Nero felt that, for all his intellectual training, he was just another one of those who would prefer to make less money, provided others made even less. Nero thought that there was at least a hint to support the idea of John being merely lucky. In other words, Nero, after all, might not need to move away from his neighbor's starter palazzo. There was hope that John would meet his undoing, for John seemed unaware of one large hidden risk he was taking, the risk of blowing up. A risk he could not see because he had too short an experience of the market, but also because he was not thoughtful enough to study history. How could John, with his coarse mind, otherwise be making so much money? This business of junk bonds depends on some knowledge of the odds, a calculation of the probability of the rare or random events. What do such fools know about odds? These traders use quantitative tools that give them the odds, and Nero disagrees with the methods used. This high-yield market resembles a nap on a railway track. One afternoon, the surprise train would run you over. You make money every month for a long time, then lose a multiple of your cumulative performance in a few hours. He has seen it with options sellers. In 1987, 1989, 1992, and 1998. One day they are taken off the exchange floors, accompanied by oversized security men, and nobody ever sees them again. The big house is simply a loan. John might end up as a luxury car salesman somewhere in New Jersey, selling to the newly rich, who no doubt would feel comfortable in his presence. Nero cannot blow up. His less oversized abode, with its 4,000 books, is his own. No market event can take it away from him. Every one of his losses is limited. His trader's dignity will never, never be threatened. John, for his part, thought of Nero as a loser, and a snobbish, overeducated loser at that. Nero was involved in a mature business. He believed that he was way over the hill.
"These prop traders are dying," he used to say. "They think they're smarter than everybody else, but they are passe."
The Red Hot Summer. Finally, in September 1998, Nero was vindicated. One morning while leaving to go to work, he saw John in his front yard, unusually smoking a cigarette. He was not wearing a business suit. He looked humble. His customary swagger was gone. Nero immediately knew that John had been fired. What he did not expect was that John also lost almost everything he had. We will see more details of John's losses in Chapter 5. Nero felt ashamed of his feelings of schadenfreude, the joy humans can experience upon their rivals' misfortunes. But he could not repress it. Aside from being unchivalrous, it was said to bring bad luck. Nero is weakly superstitious. But in this case, Nero's merriment did not come from the fact that John went back to his place in life, so much as it was from the fact that Nero's methods, beliefs, and track record had suddenly gained incredibility. Nero would be able to raise public money on his track record precisely because such a thing could not possibly happen to him. A repetition of such an event would pay off massively for him. Part of Nero's elation also came from the fact that he felt proud of his sticking to his strategy for so long, in spite of the pressure to be the alpha male. It was also because he would no longer question his trading style when others were getting rich because they misunderstood the structure of randomness and market cycles. Serotonin and randomness. Can we judge the success of people by their raw performance and their personal wealth? Sometimes, but not always. We will see how, at any point in time, a large section of businessmen with outstanding track records will be no better than randomly thrown darts. More curiously, and owing to a peculiar bias, cases will abound of the least skilled businessmen being the richest. However, they will fail to make an allowance for the role of luck in their performance. Lucky fools do not bear the slightest suspicion that they may be lucky fools. By definition, they do not know that they belong to such a category. They will act as if they deserved the money. Their strings of successes will inject them with so much serotonin, or some similar substance, that they will even fool themselves about their ability to outperform markets. Our hormonal system does not know whether our successes depend on randomness. One can notice it in their posture. A profitable trader will walk with an upright, dominant style, and will tend to talk more than a losing trader. Scientists found out that serotonin, a neurotransmitter, seems to command a large share of our human behavior. It sets a positive feedback, the virtuous cycle, but, owing to an external kick from randomness, can start a reverse motion and cause a vicious cycle. It has been shown that monkeys injected with serotonin will rise in the pecking order, which in turn causes an increase of the serotonin level in their blood, until the virtuous circle breaks and starts a vicious one. During the vicious cycle, failure will cause one to slide in the pecking order, causing a behavior that will bring about further drops in the pecking order. Likewise, an increase in personal performance, regardless of whether it is caused deterministically or by the agency of Lady Fortuna, induces a rise of serotonin in the subject, itself causing an increase of what is commonly called leadership ability. One is on a roll. Some imperceptible changes in deportment, like an ability to express oneself with serenity and confidence, make the subject look credible, as if he truly deserved the shekels. Randomness will be ruled out as a possible factor in the performance, until it rears its head once again and delivers the kick that will induce the downward spiral. A word on the display of emotions. Almost no one can conceal his emotions. Behavioral scientists believe that one of the main reasons why people become leaders is not from what skills they seem to possess, but rather from what extremely superficial impression they make on others through hardly perceptible physical signals. what we call today charisma, for example. The biology of the phenomenon is now well studied under the subject heading